I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, President Obama says more facts are needed before the U.S. rushes to conclusions in Syria, while the U.N. Secretary General again urges Syria to allow an open investigation of chemical weapons use.
On-site activities are essential if the United Nations is to be able to establish the fact and clear all the doubt.
Israel welcomes a signal from Arab League nations on land swaps. And Reporters Without Borders condemns Iraq's suspension of TV licenses. It's all ahead. Syrian state media say an enormous blast today in Damascus has killed at least 13 people and wounded 70 others. Monday, Syrian Prime Minister Wael al-Hawki escaped a bomb attack against his convoy on the west side of the capital. That blast is reported killing 6 people, including 5 civilians. Opposition forces have been increasing their attacks on Damascus as the fighting has dragged into its third year. The United Nations says more than 70,000 people have been killed in the violence. The White House has said U.S. intelligence agencies believe with varying degrees of confidence that the Syrian government has used sarin gas on a small scale against rebels. In the past, President Obama has called this a red line for a U.S. response. He has cautioned that while more evidence is needed, direct confirmation would be a game-changer for how the U.S. approaches the 2-year-old conflict. Today, at a White House news conference, he said more facts are needed before the U.S. rushes to conclusions.
What we now have is evidence that chemical weapons have been used inside of Syria, but we don't know how they were used, when they were used, who used them. We don't have a chain of custody that establishes what exactly happened. And when I am making decisions about America's national security and the potential for taking additional action in response to chemical weapon use, I've got to make sure I've got the facts. That's what the American people would expect. And if we end up rushing to judgment without hard, effective evidence, then we can find ourselves in a position where we can't mobilize the international community to support what we do. There may be objections even among some people in the region who are sympathetic with the opposition if we take action. It's important for us to do this in a prudent way. And what I've said to my team is we've got to do everything we can to investigate and establish with some certainty what exactly has happened in Syria, what is happening in Syria. We will use all the assets and resources that we have at our disposal. We'll work with the neighboring countries to see whether we can establish a clear baseline of facts. And we've also called on the United Nations to investigate.
However, the president says with enough evidence the Syrian government has used chemical weapons, the U.S. will respond.
If I can establish in a way that not only the United States but also the international community feel confident is the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime, then that is a game changer, because what that portends is potentially even more devastating attacks on civilians, and it raises the strong possibility that those chemical weapons can fall into the wrong hands and get disseminated in ways that would threaten U.S. security or the security of our allies.
By game changer, you mean U.S. military action?
By game changer, I mean that we would have to rethink the range of options that are available to us.
Mr. Obama said at the White House today that as early as last year, he asked the Pentagon, military, and intelligence officials to prepare for him what options might be available. But he refused to go into detail about what kind of military actions might be involved. He said the U.S. is already deeply engaged in trying to bring about a solution in Syria. U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon again is urging the Syrian government to allow the investigation of chemical weapons use in the nation to proceed without delay and conditions. At the United Nations in New York Monday, the U.N. chief met with Swedish scientist Åke Sällström, who will head a U.N. fact-finding mission to probe the reported use of chemical weapons in northern Syria. Secretary Ban met with reporters prior to the meeting.
Dr. Sällström and his team of experts remain ready to deploy to Syria within 24 to 48 hours. An advance team is positioned in Cyprus, as you know. I have complete confidence in the integrity and independence and professionalism of Dr. Åke Sällström and his team of experts. Even while waiting for Syrian consent to enter the country, they have been doing what they have to do, what they can do, to gather and analyze available information. These activities include a possible visit to relevant capitals. This is a crucial moment in our efforts to get the team on the ground to carry out its important task.
The UN chief also referred to a recent U.S. intelligence report about alleged chemical weapons use in Syria.
I take seriously the recent intelligence report of the United States about the use of chemical weapons in Syria. On-site activities are essential if the United Nations is to be able to establish the fact and clear all the doubts surrounding this issue. A credible and comprehensive inquiry requires full access to the site where chemical weapons are alleged to have been used. I again urge Syrian authorities to allow the investigation to proceed without delay and without any conditions.
Secretary General Ban also noted that Monday was the day set aside each year to remember the victims of chemical warfare. Israel is welcoming a signal from Arab League nations supporting the idea of using land swaps to negotiate future Israeli-Palestinian borders. Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim Al Thani said after a meeting Monday between Arab League officials and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry that his delegation backs mutually agreed comparable and minor land swaps.
The Arab League delegation affirmed that agreement should be based on the two-state solution on the basis of the 4th of June 1967 line, with the possible of comparable and mutual agreed minor swap of the land.
Israeli Justice Minister Zipi Livni said today that such a change could allow Palestinians to make the needed compromises to further negotiations. She also said the statement is a message to the Israeli people that the peace process involves not just talking with the Palestinians, but also the wider region. The Qatari Prime Minister's comments appear to represent a change in the Arab League's decade-old peace proposal for Israel. That initiative has called on Israel to withdraw from all land occupied in the 1967 Middle East War and return to its pre-1967 boundaries in return for a full peace with all Arab League members. This latest Arab position also appears to reflect an endorsement of President Obama's 2011 peace guidelines that called for Israel and the Palestinians to negotiate their borders on the basis of the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps. Here is U.S. Secretary of State Kerry.
On behalf of the President, I reaffirmed the U.S. commitment to pursue an end to the conflict based on the vision that President Obama outlined in May of 2011, two states living side by side in peace and security, brought about through direct negotiations between the parties. The U.S. and Arab League delegation agreed that peace would advance security, prosperity, and stability in the Middle East. And that is a common interest for the region and the whole world. The U.S. and Arab League delegations also agreed about the importance of this particular dialogue. And so we agreed to continue consultations on a regular basis and to meet as a group as needed in order to try to advance the efforts towards peace and an end to the conflict.
Secretary Kerry was joined at his meeting by U.S. Vice President Joe Biden and an Arab League delegation that included senior ministers from six Arab governments. VOA's Michael Lippin asked State Department correspondent Scott Stearns if the presence of so many U.S. and Arab League officials reflect a serious commitment to Israeli-Palestinian peace.
Yes, certainly. This was a good turnout. Both Secretary Kerry and Vice President Biden have long careers in the Senate, where they will have known some of these Arab ministers in the past and are certainly conversant with the issues of Middle East peace, which obviously been an issue for a generation of American politicians. So, yes, I mean, this was certainly a high-level meeting between the Arab League and the United States. The fact that it followed the consultations that Secretary Kerry has had in the region, I think, was an opportunity for him to give them an idea of how he sees the process moving forward, having spoken several times now with both President Abbas and Prime Minister Netanyahu, and what the Arab League can do to help move that process along.
VOA State Department correspondent Scott Stearns. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas repeatedly has called on Israel to accept the 1967 lines as a basis for peace talks. Palestinians claim all of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza Strip for a future state. A diplomatic dispute is deepening between Washington and Ankara over the Turkish Prime Minister's planned visit to the Gaza Strip. Ankara has rejected a public request by Washington to postpone next month's planned visit. Dorian Jones has details from Istanbul.
Ankara has strongly criticized a call from U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to postpone a planned visit by the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan to the Palestinian enclave of Gaza. Kerry warned that Mr. Erdogan's visit could undermine his recent efforts to revitalize peace talks between the Palestinians and Israelis. Turkish Deputy Prime Minister Bulent Arınç rejected the call.
Diplomatik açıdan mahsurludur. Yanlıştır, doğru değildir.
He says Turkey finds it diplomatically objectionable, and he wants the world to know that Turkey has the power to do whatever it wishes. Diplomatic columnist Semih Diz of the Turkish newspaper Taraf says the Gaza visit is being driven by Turkish domestic considerations for Mr. Erdogan.
I think this is tied in with domestic politics and his public image in and amongst his Islamic supporters in the region. I think he's walking a very delicate line at the moment because clearly the grand strategic requirement is that he reconcile with Israel and get back on track in terms of some Middle East processes. And he has to appear to his own public opinion that he's sticking to his word. And Gaza, of course, is one way of trying to show this.
Mr. Erdogan has good relations with the Hamas leadership that controls the Gaza Strip. Columnist Adiz says Ankara believes it can enhance Palestinian unification efforts between Hamas and rival Fatah, which controls the West Bank.
Foreign Minister Davutoğlu said that the issue is not Erdogan's going to Gaza, but it's about Palestinian reconciliation. There is some talk that reconciliation talks between al-Fatah and Hamas are going to speed up in the coming periods. But I don't think he would want to, in the end, appear to be a spoiler in terms of Palestinian reconciliation. And this is where his real difficulty is.
After months of acrimony, relations between Turkey and Israel thawed recently when Israel apologized to Turkey over the 2010 killing of 9 Turks aboard an aid ship trying to break an Israeli economic embargo of the Gaza Strip. U.S. President Barack Obama helped broker the apology during a recent visit to Israel. The dispute over Mr. Erdogan's visit to Gaza could overshadow his planned visit to Washington, scheduled for early next month. Kerry said it could be on the agenda.
So our sense is that it would be more helpful to wait for the right circumstances. I think the Prime Minister listened very graciously to that. I think he's been very thoughtful and sensitive about it. If needs be, we certainly can have further conversation about it when he comes to Washington.
Political scientist Cengiz Aktar of Istanbul's Bahçeşehir University says U.S. diplomatic pressure on Mr. Erdogan is expected to grow.
Americans have another agenda. They will repeat that and they will do everything to make sure that he's not going there. But that won't destroy the relationship that exists between the two countries. But at the end of the day, he may be responsive to this call by Kerry and the Obama administration.
For now, Mr. Erdogan has ruled out any change to his planned visit to Gaza. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
Meantime, an Israeli airstrike has killed a Palestinian man in the Gaza Strip, the first deadly airstrike in the Palestinian territory since a truce 5 months ago ended 8 days of fighting that killed more than 100 people. VOA's Scott Bob reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli defense forces say the airstrike targeted Haitham Mishal, a Gaza resident who they said was a member of an Islamist militant group. A spokesman for the Gaza Health Ministry said he was a policeman. The Israeli announcement said Mishal played a role in the rockets fired 2 weeks ago from Egypt's Sinai Desert that hit the southern Israeli city of Eilat. There were no casualties. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Israel would respond to any attacks. He says the strike is a continuation of Israeli policy of refusing to accept the sporadic firing of rockets either from Gaza or the Sinai. A dozen rockets fired by militants in Gaza have landed in southern Israel in recent weeks without causing any casualties. Islamic militants have become active in the Sinai since security deteriorated there following the fall of former President Hosni Mubarak. Israel says many of the militants in Sinai have infiltrated from Gaza. Israel accuses the Hamas movement that controls Gaza of responsibility for the activities of all these groups. A Hamas spokesman called the attack a dangerous and unjustified escalation. The airstrike in Gaza came amid rising tensions in the West Bank. An Israeli settler was stabbed to death Tuesday by a Palestinian man near the Palestinian city of Nablus. Israeli police commander Yaakov Shabtai said the Palestinian subsequently grabbed a gun and began firing. He says two policemen positioned nearby opened fire and wounded the attacker, who was taken to a nearby Israeli hospital. He said Israeli security forces were investigating, but initial indications were that the suspect acted alone. It was the first killing of an Israeli by a Palestinian in the West Bank in a year and a half. 9 Palestinians have been killed in clashes with Israeli security forces in the West Bank since the beginning of the year. Scott Bob, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Reporters Without Borders is strongly condemning Iraq's suspension of the licenses of the pan-Arabic television network Al Jazeera and 9 other satellite television operations. Iraq accuses the news organizations of inciting sectarian violence. The statement from the Communications and Media Commission says the networks are encouraging what it calls criminal acts of revenge against security forces deployed by the Shiite-led government to quell violence. We spoke about the license suspensions with Delphine Algol, U.S. Director of Reporters Without Borders.
We know that Iraq has experienced sectarian conflict for years, and the surge in violence of the past week suggests that it could escalate into a civil war at any time. But the satellite TV stations affected by the ban have all been covering this development. And, of course, they were all doing their job. We also know that some of them carried speeches by Sunni leaders, even like urging young men to take arms against the government. And 9 of the 10 TV stations are Sunni financed. That is not to justify the decision of the Iraqi authorities, but it's to try to explain the audience, in a sense, why the authority decided to ban this TV. But of course, as I say, we don't justify, there's no justification to ban this TV channel, and we firmly condemn this decision.
Do you see this as the government just using it as a way to silence their opponents?
Yeah, it's clearly, this decision is to suspend these licenses is clearly a way of silencing the government's opponents. And as the stations are all based abroad, the Iraqi government cannot prevent them broadcasting, but they can ban the Iraqi-based crews to cover events or to move freely in the country, and that's what they do. They just silence the government's opponents.
And what would you like to be done about this?
Well, we hope that the decision can be cancelled. But, you know, I also would like to highlight the general situation for journalists in Iraq. You know, Iraq, in our last Press Freedom Index, is ranked at the 150th position, which means that the security situation continues to be very worrying for journalists in Iraq. Three journalists were killed in connection with their work in 2012 and seven in 2011. Journalists are constantly obstructed. They are exposed to threats, murder attempts, denial of access. Just to give you an idea of the general context, just like at the beginning of April, on April 1st, four newspapers were attacked by men armed with knives and clubs, and six journalists were hospitalized. And it's still not clear who was exactly behind this attack.
Dilvan Algol, U.S. Director of Reporters Without Borders. A statement from Al Jazeera, based in Qatar, said it was astonished by the suspensions, saying it covers all sides of news stories in Iraq. Last year, Iraqi media regulators ordered the closure of more than 40 media outlets, including the Voice of America and the British Broadcasting Corporation. Iraqi refugees continue to arrive in the United States in large numbers, fleeing bombings and other violence 10 years after the then U.S. President George W. Bush declared the successful conclusion of combat operations following the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq. Many of these refugees have settled in the U.S. state of Michigan. Kane Faribault reports on their story from Detroit for VOA Television.
The mission accomplished banner across the bridge of the U.S. Navy aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln helped President George W. Bush convey a sense of achievement to Americans less than 2 months after the invasion of Iraq.
In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
But that sentiment soon evaporated as U.S. and allied casualties mounted in the post-invasion insurgency that left Iraq on the brink of civil war.
It's not accomplished, and the Americans that were living in Iraq, they were working, they know it is not accomplished.
On October 31st, 2010, Mohaned Gadaje was one of hundreds of Christian worshippers attending an evening mass at Our Lady of Salvation when terrorists stormed the Catholic Church. 58 people died in the attack, including several of Gadaje's family members.
We lost three in that church, and there are no security at all in Iraq. If they are not going to bomb the churches, they will bomb the cars. They will use the bombing belts to bomb themselves with innocent people.
Kanaje decided to flee Iraq with his family soon after the church attack. He settled in Michigan and has since struggled to make ends meet.
There's no jobs. Living in U.S., it's hard too. It is not only the security, it's not enough. Living in Iraq was hard, but here it's harder too.
So just last year, 2012, we received 4,600 Iraqis here.
Madiha Tariq is a program coordinator for the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, or ACCESS, in Michigan. The continued insecurity in Iraq has dramatically increased the number of refugees in southeast Michigan, which is home to the largest Arab-American population in the United States. Tariq says, aside from the physical injuries and ailments, half of all incoming Iraq refugees suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, and at least one-fourth suffer from severe depression.
I don't know what it means when he said that the mission was accomplished, because for us, I think that opened a whole new can of worms. We are happy to receive our new neighbors that are our Iraqi refugees, but they come with a lot of baggage, and there's a lot of fixing to be done.
Mohaned Gadaje is still fixing his frayed nerves as he struggles to eke out a living in the U.S. for his family with help from ACCESS.
I will never return to Iraq. I can't go back to Iraq. This is my second home. The first one is Iraq, and America is my second home.
A second home where his first priority is providing a better future for his children. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Sterling Heights, Michigan.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.